You may remember on Friday when the president declared the national emergency, predicted the future.
And we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there. And we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court.
The first part of his prediction has now come true. 16 states are challenging the plan to build a border wall without the approval of Congress. The suit calls the declaration of a national emergency unlawful and unconstitutional, showing flagrant disregard for separation of powers. All 16 attorneys general involved are Democrats. Washington State is not part of this lawsuit. Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who has sued the Trump administration more than 30 times, is waiting this one out. The emergency declaration is going to shift some Pentagon money around, and, of course, we have some big defense installations in western Washington. So we called up Congressman Derek Kilmer to ask if Washington State is going to be affected, and if so, do we have any say in the matter?
That's a really good question, and I think the short answer is we don't know yet, and I'm not sure the Defense Department knows yet. I am concerned about this emergency declaration in part because of what you just said. This takes money away from the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense is the largest employer in the district I represent. There is real concern that money will be pulled away from training facilities, funds that are appropriate and important for our military's readiness. There's concern about the fact that this could pull funding away from housing for military families. We just had a hearing in our nation's capital highlighting some of the just terrible conditions we're asking military families to live in. So there's first and foremost concern about when you're pulling these appropriated funds away, it's a zero-sum game. That's coming at the expense of something that was going to be funded for the Department of Defense. And what we fund in the military construction arena are things like training facilities, facilities at our naval base to make sure that they can maintain our fleet, housing for military families. That's what gets funded in that military construction budget. So that, I think, is the fundamental concern. Beyond that, though, there's concerns around, you know, one, I think this is a really concerning precedent. You know, we have a system of government that's, you know, founded on a separation of powers, and the fundamental power of Congress is the power of the purse. This is sort of uncharted territory where the president has said, well, I know that Democrats and Republicans in the House and in the Senate have come to a spending agreement. I'm going to ignore that and pull some of those dollars away to fund what he has declared a national emergency. And then I guess the third concern is a real question around the legitimacy of this emergency declaration. I mean, listen, there are clearly things that need to be improved within our immigration system and even in our border security system. And as I shared the last time we talked, I'm a sponsor of a bipartisan bill to do a mile-by-mile assessment to look at our southern border and to see what makes the most sense. But it's worth acknowledging attempted border crossings are actually at a low point right now. Drugs primarily are intercepted at our points of entry, at our ports of entry, not in between those ports of entry where the wall would be constructed. And the president himself said, I didn't need to do this. That, I think, really undermines the notion that this is a national emergency. And I think calls into the question the legitimacy and the legality of this action by the president.
Congressman Derek Kilmer, who represents Washington's 6th District, which includes part of Tacoma, as well as the Kitsap and Olympic Peninsulas. Anna Scott is here. I know what that means. We're going to be talking about what the legislature has been doing in Olympia.
That's right.
They're discussing health care, aren't they? They're discussing universal health care, aren't they?
They are.
Can you apply the term universal if it only covers the state?
I believe they believe so.
Okay. So what would it do?
So this is actually different. We had talked about one. There's one bill in the legislature right now that would create a universal health care kind of right away. That bill has not gotten a hearing. These now are two bills in both the House and the Senate from a pair of Democrats that would kind of take the long view, right? Look at a pathway to creating universal health care in our state. Democratic Representative Nicole Macri is behind the House version that would create that pathway and by forming a work group.
To look at multiple things, including who is uninsured or underinsured and how do we get them coverage? What are the factors we need to look at to make sure that we're driving affordability through the system? We see lots of healthcare cost inflation, and so how do we manage the costs of healthcare delivery? What are the innovations we can implement? And then how do we pay for it?
Now, unlike the bill we talked about before, which was Senator Hasegawa's bill that would look at capital gains to pay for that, this is kind of open-ended at this point. If this work group were to be created, they'd explore all of the possibilities. Now, her bill hasn't gotten a hearing yet. The companion, though, from Senator Emily Randall did get a hearing yesterday, and Randall explained why this was important for her.
I've heard over and over from neighbors who are worried about being able to make the choice to pay or make the choice on whether to purchase their own medication or their kids' medication every month. We have folks who are drowning in medical debt, and we need to take real action to make a change for our community.
But she says at this point, under the Trump administration, it's clear that we cannot get this done right now. That's why they're looking at the longer view.
This piece of legislation would allow us to create an actionable plan on how to ensure that despite the constant attacks from the federal level and our inability to access the Medicare and Medicaid waivers we might need to implement universal health care now, that we'll be ready when we do have the ability to get those waivers and to ensure that folks in our community have health care that they can depend on.
And Sadiqa Sakin with the Seattle King County NAACP told the committee that this is vital for her community.
As Dr. Martin Luther King stated, of all of the forms of inequality, injustice in health care is the most shocking and inhumane. We know this to be true. Disparities in access to quality care still disproportionately affects communities of color. In King County specifically, minorities and low-income communities have little to no access to specialty care, behavioral health care, and dental care.
We also heard from several doctors who came out to show their support.
While I was working at a low-income clinic in Bellingham, I signed two death certificates for two women, one who died of heart disease, one of breast cancer, and tried to list as the underlying cause of death lack of health insurance, sent it in, said, you can't do that. That's not permissible. I said, well, I think that was their underlying cause of death.
Last year, I feel like we're going backwards. Now I have more patients with insurance avoiding a clinic visit. Cost of accessing care cannot be so high that it's unusable.
Now, over a dozen people came to show their support for this bill. A couple people signed in against, but did not speak. But there were some people who were frustrated at the fact that this was going at a slow pace instead of instantaneous.
It's time for us to put our inflated egos aside and learn from all the other countries who have figured out how to do this for far less cost and far better outcomes. We can learn from Canada, a wonderful, caring country who built their healthcare system one province at a time. But you see, they had a real leader.
She was told to give her written statement at the end of that. So, this got a hearing. The other one in the House hasn't. I think this, if there's going to be any chance of anything getting done, we might see this one pass and create this work group, which would have to, the healthcare authority would have to do that. And that would be by November 15th, 2020.
So who's being turned away? Were there stories of people who were basically told, go home and die because you haven't got enough money?
Well, from that doctor in Bellingham right there said, you know, they didn't get their care. And I think that's what the other doctor was saying as well, is that people might have insurance, but she goes on about how tests, lab tests, and care that's not considered preventable, you get all of these huge costs. So people avoid that. They avoid, mm-hmm. or they don't. She talked about how people call in to get their medications from her, but they don't want to come for the appointment that might be required to see if that medication's actually working, because it's not a preventable visit, and then they're getting charged for it.
This is a doctor talking, right?
Yeah, this is a doctor.
So has this doctor who testified actually said, no, don't come to me because you can't afford it?
Well, she didn't go into that in her testimony.
Some of the problem may be that people are worried they'll go bankrupt, and so they decide on their own not to go, whereas if you went in, you incurred the bill, unless they're going to actually garnish you your wages.
Right.
So you have a big bill.
And I think there's certainly that fear from people, absolutely. And I know for my doctor, Will, if you don't have insurance or something like that at the time, they do like a different rate for you.
Yeah.
And so they generally will work with you. But I think it depends on your medical situation, right? If you have stacks and stacks and stacks of those, people just don't like to be buried under that debt.
I mean, maybe people just have to start going despite the cost and see how far the hospital or doctor will go to squeeze the money out of them.
Well, but then you end up back where we were,
though, right?
I would agree. But then you end up back where we were before the Affordable Health Care Plan, right, where everybody's going to the ER to get their treatment because they know what's the worst that can happen.
Well, I'm saying don't go to the ER. Yeah. Go to your regular doctor and explain, look, I haven't got the money, but I'll do my best to pay and maybe force the issue that way. I mean, I don't know how else you – what the bad thing – the thing I'm worried about is that people, because they're worried about seeing a big number on their bill, don't get the health care they need to stay alive.
There's a lot of people who do that. I mean, it's absolutely the truth. And I think it's fair. You can talk about people in low-income communities who don't go get their – what they need to get done, and then the access to care as well, and then people in the middle income areas who the healthcare is very expensive. It's only getting more expensive, yeah. And who maybe skip some of the visits that aren't going to be covered because they can't meet their deductible every year. Things.
Right. It just seems to me if everybody went anyway, whether they could pay or not, suddenly you would have pressure, obviously, from the doctors and the hospitals carrying all these unpaid balances, saying, "Look, do something about this. We don't want to bankrupt these people, but there needs to be a solution."
And at a certain point, I don't know what those doctors do, right? They can't see everyone and not get paid. So I don't know how that plays out, but it's certainly, you know, worth an effort. I think we'll hear more discussion about the universal health care aspect, though, moving forward, at least in our state.
Car Raiders, Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Choke Points, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. The 405-167 interchange in Renton is one of the most congested areas in the state. The backups are miles long almost every day, but the state's fix is starting to take shape, and Chris has the update.
The flyover ramp that they've been building there for the last 3 years, connecting 405 and 167, should be opening in a couple of days. Governor Inslee and the others are going to be at the ramp later today for a ceremonial ribbon cutting. They were supposed to open right afterwards, but the snow kind of kept them from opening on time. They've got a little bit more striping left to do. But regardless, this ramp connects the hot lanes on 167 and the HOV lanes on 405, eliminating a lot of the weaving on northbound 167 and southbound 405 that causes those daily backups. Kim Henry is in charge of this project for the Washington Department of Transportation.
There won't be any needing to weave across multiple lanes of traffic, regardless of whether you're going northbound into Bellevue or if you're coming southbound down towards Kent. You'll be able to just stay right in the lane and just move from one freeway to the other freeway.
This is all part of the expansion of the toll lanes between Linwood and I-5 at the Port of Tacoma along the 405 and 167 corridor. Henry says it doesn't really make sense for that hot lane to stop.
Today on 167, we have a hot lane that just ends at 405. So this new flyover ramp will provide a seamless connection for that lane that's ending.
So for those of you that are new to the area or have forgotten, I'm going to lay out the grand plan here of what's been going on. Once this flyover ramp opens in a couple of days, construction will begin to widen 405 between Renton and Bellevue. That new lane that will be created will be combined with the current HOV lane along that stretch to create a two-lane express toll lane facility, basically mirroring the current lanes between Bellevue and Bothell. So we will have an express lane corridor that runs the entire length of 405. And when that widening is complete, in about 5 years, Henry says the congestion that you see today in Renton should disappear.
We are really seeing a difference at the day of opening that's like night and day. It is going to be essentially free flow within the express toll lanes and almost free flow within the general purpose lanes.
And that's based on the projections that they have looking at the forecasted growth and whatnot. And now while all of that is happening, to go to the even grander scheme of things for people who have not who have forgotten, the Gateway project will also be getting underway in that time frame. This is the project to finally finish 167 from Puyallup over to I-5 into Tacoma. Now, that is also going to be a toll road. The project also expands 509 to the Port of Tacoma, which will also be tolled. So, the Gateway project also extends 509 from the south end of SeaTac Airport to I-5 so that there will be a direct connection from the south right into SeaTac Airport. That road will also be tolled. Now, have you heard the word toll?
Yes, I have.
You've heard the word toll. So basically, the entire scheme or the plan is to have a buy-in system for an HOV lane, express lane, call it what you want, from Linwood all the way down 405 to 167 in Renton, all the way down through Puyallup and over to I-5 in Tacoma. Wow. That's the plan, and that's going to be going on over the next 9 or 10 years as they expand out the express toll lane system. The hot lanes on 167 are going to be made permanent, and so that's the grand plan for the entire east side and then through the south end over to Tacoma.
So there will be an alternative route to Tacoma where you can get on Linwood and drive without ever stopping.
Well, you would think so, because ask the people right now who are stuck in the express toll lane between Linwood and Bellevue. Or Linwood and Bothell.
Yeah.
One of the part of this overall scheme in the next 10 years, I keep calling it a scheme, I mean plan, is that they're going to add another lane there between Linwood and Bothell to give them two lanes as well, because that one stretch there it doesn't work because there's just too much volume and
will then start hauling in immense amounts of money, right?
Yes.
To maintain and expand this if necessary.
Yes. And the thing about the way the bill is written, which is going to get a hearing, I believe, Thursday, that would allow all of this to happen, it would say that all of the money that is raised above and beyond the operations cost has to go back into the corridor from which the tolls were created. So if you're just driving along 167, the money stays in 167. Once you go to 405 and you're paying a toll on that section, that money stays on the 405 corridor. Like, they've made $75 million in 3 years in the express toll lane system, and only operations were 25. So that's 50 mil that's going to go right back into the 405 corridor.
Any consideration to my impression that the reason the express toll lanes in the north work is that that's a really high income area, and south, the south segment, 167, not so high income,
right? And that's why you've seen the toll rates there not obviously as high as what we've seen in Bellevue. And of course, the further south you go, the less the population, I mean, at least compared to Renton. But yeah, it's exploding in terms of population down there in that part of South King and North Pierce. So they could use this. But yeah, you're right. It'll be interesting how they set those toll rates, what those toll rates are going to look like. From what I've heard, like on the certain segment from 509 to the Port of Tacoma, it's a buck or two, something like that, kind of like what we see on the tunnel. But that has yet to be set.
Time for your daily dose of kindness. A fifth grade student in Lone Tree, Colorado, was given a life-changing gift by a lifelong friend. Tyler and Thane, they've known each other since pre-K. They are alike in so many ways, but different in one big way.
I can't see any strict colors. Like, every color has to be in a shade of either black or white.
Tyler is colorblind, so his buddy Thane did something about it.
I did see a video on YouTube of these teenagers reacting to these colorblind glasses. Saved up my money, and then I went on Amazon.
He bought him the $100 glasses to correct colorblindness with his own chore money. Thane presented the glasses to Tyler in class.
Ooh, look at that.
Do you see it, Tyler?
Mm-hmm. I didn't know.
Those are all other kids talking. In the video posted by the Denver channel, Tyler is stunned, silent, but frantically picking up colorful objects and admiring them. Clearly a life-changing gift from his lifelong buddy.
Just to bring him, like, joy and make him happy.
I don't think I know anybody else that would do that. It's a lot better than without these glasses.
I just am really excited for him so that he can see color.
So simple, so kind. These stories always fascinate me. Many move us to tears as the person receiving these glasses finally sees our beautiful, colorful world. Also interesting, men much more likely to be colorblind than women. About 8% of men, just 0.5% of women have colorblindness. That's because the genes responsible for colorblindness are in the X chromosome. Women have two. So if there's a deficiency in one, the other X can make up for it. But men, you got to deal with your colorblindness.
Yes, we do. Now the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is from 710 ESPN, the only world-class surfer over there, Danny O'Neill, just back from Hawaii. How was it?
It was awesome. But you can't say world-class surfer when you injure your ribs laying down on a longboard.
Well, you know.
How did that happen?
I don't know. But it did.
Depends on which world you're referring to.
Yeah, yeah. The very small world, a population of one, I would be the best surfer there.
There was a piece in Seattle Times about how our still unnamed NHL team is going to enhance fan participation. And I guess this is a trend around the league where you actually follow along either on your smartphone or something else.
There's a fan. We're getting better ways to measure athlete performance. And in hockey, it's about to come there. We now have ways of tracking athlete movement. And you've seen it a little bit if you watched football broadcasts,
right,
where they will show catch probability and other things. It's usually using Amazon.
They turn into a video game.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's about to come to hockey, where you can see the speed of skate, the speed a guy's skating at, how fast does he accelerate, how hard was that slap shot. All of those things are about to be available. And you're building a new arena. And so there's this question of how do you utilize that? And I think it's really interesting because NHL Seattle, we still don't have a nickname, but they do have he's a senior vice president who's going to be in charge of fan engagement. And his emphasis, where he said, was keep people's eyes on the ice, keep them watching the game, which I think will be really interesting. This is one of the challenges hockey's had when they've tried to market their game, is that it is... For diehard hockey fans, there's no need to change anything about it. But we've seen glowing pucks. At one point, they tried to use that on the Fox broadcast, where they would change. So once the puck hit a certain speed, it would actually change colors.
So you'd know how fast it was going.
That's if you're watching on TV, though.
Correct.
Right? You're talking about in-person technology.
But it's the same principle of you're going to deliver things via a screen to people who are watching the game.
Well, what about if they used, you know, Oculus Rift or virtual reality glasses? Like, you put on those glasses for a 3D movie. Why can't you opt in, wear some glasses? You're still watching the ice, but you get to see all these cool...
That'd be interesting. I don't know if I want to see a bunch of cyborgs watching hockey, though. But you're right.
They're still engaged. They're still watching the ice. They just get some added virtual reality bonuses.
You just found the spot where I become a fuddy-duddy.
Oh.
Because as you brought that up, I'm like, I don't want that. I don't want a bunch of people with their heads and goggles. Watch the ice!
But you are watching the ice. Goggles give you an overlay.
But you're cordoning yourself off. Like...
I
think it's an interesting question. We're now at a point where we have more information available about the games we're watching than ever before. Some of it's very important.
I feel like it would help a novice like me.
But I think actually watching the game helps most.
No, I need somebody to explain it to me.
Well,
I can't just watch a game and figure it out.
That's the person sitting right next to you is be able to say, like, oh, here's this line shift. Watch how this comes through. That's part of the fun.
How annoying is that, though, when somebody's constantly like, what was that?
You know what? I don't think that's annoying at all.
I should go to a hockey game with you.
I think that's part of the response. We need to find someone who's more well-versed in hockey than me. But I think that's part of the fun of being a sports fan, is actually being able to communicate your enjoyment, what you like about it, to someone else and get them to share their... I feel a missionary zeal when it comes to spreading the joy of sports each and every morning here on the Sports Insider, Dave.
By the way, I just so you know, the one thing you need to prepare yourself for is the smell of hockey.
Oh, I've been to a hockey game.
Just see, the closer you get to, there's nothing quite like dripping wet with sweat leather, which is the gloves, the hot goalie pads. It's a very unique smell that I actually kind of miss from my days of covering.
Are you serious?
A team. Yeah.
It's disgusting.
Yeah, it is.
No,
but
like,
it kind of provides you're at a barn, a rink, when you get that smell. It's pretty good.
Now, I lived, after I graduated from college, I went and worked for a couple years in Connecticut at ESPN. And one of my coworkers, Jamie McDonald, was a hockey player. He played, I think he played on his college team. He might not have, but he definitely played recreational hockey. And he would take his hockey equipment out before he would go and play. And he liked to warm it up so it wasn't cold. So he would stick a hairdryer into the...
Oh, that smell.
It was disgusting what he did. I referred to his bag of hockey equipment as the dead body. It was foul.
You never washed it?
No, you can't wash it.
No, you can't.
Like big, stiff, like think about stiff ski gloves.
Can't dry clean.
You can't do anything.
And
I guess you could squirt some Febreze in there. But
yeah.
At that point, like hip pads, a girdle. They wear a girdle to protect it. It was nasty what would happen.
So that's the real reason there's a plexiglass screen around the rink.
Yes, to keep the filthy.
Soak it in, baby.
It's disgusting. It is foul. That will be part of the sensory experience that they will deliver. Colleen will have you strapped instead of having the goggles.
Colleen,
we're just going
to
strap a glove around your nose.
Colleen's waiting for the aroma attachment for the iPhone.
I'm all in.
Yeah. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Surf's up. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. On Tuesdays, we call up David Ferrenthal, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter at The Washington Post. And I wanted to ask you about the Andrew McCabe interview on 60 Minutes and just this whole idea that the president could possibly be an agent of Russia. One alternative scenario that I'm reading on some conservative websites is that McCabe and the others are all part of this deep state trying to undermine Donald Trump because he doesn't play by the traditional rules. So is there any way you can prove this is not true?
No. I mean, the only thing I know about this whole episode comes from McCabe, who's made these public statements. He's talked about how they discuss perhaps trying to gather members of the cabinet together to try to remove Trump under the 25th Amendment, which is really meant to remove like mentally incapacitated presidents. And there has been some discussion, or McCabe has described some discussion of, you know, is Trump an agent of Russia? Is he acting as an agent of the Russian government? But I think there's two things, you know, that go against the theory that this is some sort of coup that they were trying to plot. And the word coup has been used a lot, actually, in right-wing media. One, the FBI, and particularly James Comey, did more than just about anybody to put Donald Trump in office. Comey's letter to Congress the week before the election saying Hillary Clinton was under investigation again, I think it was probably one of the most important factors tipping the election to Trump. So if these guys were agents of the deep state trying to defeat Donald Trump, they were truly terrible at it. The other one is that the folks, McCabe, Rosenstein, all these folks, they discussed this. They apparently talked about whether they should investigate Trump as a Russian agent. But they trusted the process. And when a special prosecutor, special counsel, Robert Mueller, was appointed, they handed this whole investigation over to Mueller and said, run with it. You know, there was nothing about this process from McCabe's end where they were like, we're out to get Donald Trump and we'll stop at nothing. When they felt like there was a existing investigation that would handle their concerns, they handed it off.
And on this 25th Amendment scenario, there was a piece on CNN this morning challenging that whole idea because it would be the vice president who would have to initiate this removal process for the president that would then be followed by a vote of cabinet officials, which is an absurd thought, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it is absurd. I mean, like I said, this is designed for the scenario where the president has a mental breakdown, the president has a stroke, or, you know, it's not designed to remove erratic presidents or presidents who make weird or unorthodox policy decisions, or even presidents that you feel are acting illegally. That's what the impeachment is for. You know, 25th Amendment is for sort of a medical or psychological emergency. I don't think that there was anything about Trump's behavior then that warranted that, or honestly, that could have even come close to succeeding. Trump's own cabinet's going to vote him out after he gave them their jobs? No way.
Okay, so one of the things that you've been doing, you've been following the business dealings of the Trump Organization, which is run by Eric now, and what they've been trying to do. One of the things the Trump Organization was planning to do was expand its hotels in states that support the president. What's the status of that?
It's kaput. It just died last week. This is a really interesting part of their strategy, and it's fascinating they couldn't make it work. So right after the Trump won in 2016, the Trump Organization announced these two new lines of hotels. One was sort of for hipsters in mid-sized big cities. The other one was kind of like a roadside motel hotel, Hampton Inn kind of thing, called American Idea. And that was aimed specifically at Trump voters. The idea being Trump's existing hotels are super, super high-end. They're all in these very liberal big cities. They're not places Trump's voters from Mississippi, Alabama, West Virginia can stay. But that he would then now put a bunch of hotels in those places where you could, if you like Trump, you could stay at his hotel. And the first one was supposed to be in Cleveland, Mississippi, which is a town in the Delta. It's home to a blues museum. And they worked on it and worked on it and worked on it for 2 years, and they tried to get other projects off the ground. And then last week, Eric Trump just announced the whole idea. Both new hotel lines are completely dead. And he's blamed politics and said, oh, there's so much scrutiny by the media. You know, damned if we do, damned if we don't. But they actually didn't seem to put a lot of effort into this. And it requires a lot of effort to get a hotel chain off the ground, whether you're president or not. So I'm not sure that the media is entirely to blame. I think the Trump Organization didn't seem to really work that hard at getting this chain off the ground.
But there was this idea that Eric was going to reorient the company towards providing the kind of accommodations that Trump's base could afford. Is that what you're saying?
That was the idea. I mean, there's an imperative for them anyway to do that because the hotel business, as everybody knows now, is about chains, right? So I stay at the Hampton Inn a bunch of times, I get a bunch of Hilton points, then I can stay at the DoubleTree. The Trump Hotel doesn't really have that feeder system, cheap hotels that you can build up points and splurge at the big, you know, $700 a night Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C. So they were trying to build that, but they were trying to build it on Trump's political base, and it just didn't work. For one thing, the hotels aimed at Trump's political base didn't even have the word Trump in the name.
And I also noticed that your latest investigative project is an investigation into the golf simulator at the White House. What's that about?
Yeah, so Trump in the last few weeks has installed this really high-tech golf simulator in the White House. It's kind of a room-sized system where you hit the ball into a screen and the computers track the ball, and then you see your ball, you know, digitally disappear.
All right, I've seen those, yeah.
Golf course in front of him. Yeah, yeah. So he's got them in his golf courses. And Obama had one, which was apparently a little bit less sophisticated, in the middle of the government shutdown when Trump didn't play golf for a record number of days. I think it was like 70 days. He had this thing installed. In the court of the White House, he has not played it once.
Wait a minute. So he had it installed so that he could play golf inside the White House during the shutdown, presumably so it wouldn't, the optics wouldn't be so bad, but never used it?
That's what the White House says. He had it installed at a cost to himself. They say he paid more than $50,000, but he has not used it once.
Well, that's not a scandal if he paid for it himself. He's just, you know.
No, it's not a scandal. Not a scandal at all. Other presidents, you know, Richard Nixon had a putting green, Joe Ford had a bowling alley. This is the kind of thing the presidents have done in the past.
Okay, since we last spoke, I don't know, approximately 20 more Democratic candidates have announced they're running for office. So I ask you this every week. Are there any new names that have floated to the surface in terms of having an actual shot at it?
Well, Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, had a CNN town hall last night that seems to have been pretty well received. People in Washington, I mean, this is a real inside the beltway view, think that she is a very smart, pragmatic person who's always really overperformed the Democratic expectations in Minnesota. And people think she's somebody to watch. As you said, she's one of 20, and I think now it's one of 21, because Bernie Sanders has already said this morning that he will run for president.
Right.
So I'm not predicting Klobuchar will win, but I think she's somebody to watch, along with people like Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, because they have a lot of policy ideas and seem to have sort of the experience in Washington that may help them stand out.
David Farenthold from The Washington Post. David, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And I thought we should explain to you why all of a sudden the 1967 Chevy Impala in black is suddenly the hottest old car in America.
Because this 1967 Chevrolet Impala would turn out to be the most important car. No, the most important object in pretty much the whole universe.
And it's because of a fantasy, what would you call it, Dyer?
Fantasy horror. Car guru show, maybe?
Dyer Oxley does Northwest Nerd at MyNorthwest.com, and he is a follower of Supernatural, whose stars drive around in this 1967 black Chevy Impala, which is like, would you say it has attained the status of the converted hearse from Ghostbusters?
Or? Yeah, that or the Knight Rider car. Or the time machine from Back to the Future. I've seen people convert that
into the DeLorean.
It is the third main character on the show, commonly referred to as Baby. And it is essentially what these two brothers drive around America fighting ghosts and demons and things like that in. I talked to Rick Blevins, who is a guy out in Kansas. A few years ago, he was a sleep tech at a hospital. And because of his work on these cars with fans, his full-time job is now just converting 67 Impalas, which he calls grandma cars, into these supernatural screen-accurate cars. He's so good, they actually used his cars and his props on the show. They just found him as a fan, and they said, this is as good as ours, and they grabbed him. He was telling me about those costs, and he said maybe at the low end, like a small block engine, you can get like $45,000 to get started. To make it screen accurate, and then you're probably looking at maybe $10,000 to get the authentic props to fill the weapons trunk with, which will have like holy oil and crosses and things like that. And then if you want like a big block car that's, you know, more fancy, then you're probably looking upwards of $75,000. And he was telling me, you know, off the record stories, I don't want to name names, of just he's been in the scene and people have said, hey, if you can find me Supernatural Impala, I will drop $80,000 on it right now, $75,000.
So he now can make a living just doing this.
Yeah, he said he has a, actually, why don't I just let Rick speak for himself.
They're for fans. They're buying their car, and then they're just having them shipped here to the shop, and we're building Supernatural cars. Right now in the shop, I've got 15 Supernatural Impalas that need to be built, and there's more on the way.
15?
15 right now. One of those cars is in Washington. And I followed this one. It's called a Venator Impala, put together by Brad and Mary Camp. Huge fans. And they, a few years ago, found a white, run-down 1967 Chevy Impala. They think maybe some possums were living in it at some time point in time. And they shipped it out here, realized this is more work than they thought, and figured if they're going to go for it, they're going to go for it. Shipped it back out to Kansas. And 2 years later, it showed up. It was all black. I was there when it was delivered in Edmonds just last month. It has a little pentagram painted under the hood, which wards off demons.
Of course,
as we all know. And it had all the props, you know, like special props that they needed. Fans of the show will understand things like this. It had a little army man jammed into the cigarette ashtray. And I talked to Brad as well for this whole journey. And I think what he said, and you'll pick up on this one word that he repeatedly uses, as to why he and so many other fans have done this.
The storyline is about hunting demons, and it's really about family. It really struck a chord with us because there's a lot of friends and family who are not related to us, but they're part of our family. If you've met fans of the show, they really are truly part of a bigger family. And for us, it's really just extending a little bit of our family through building a car. And it's actually become part of our, I think, one of the children in our family right now. You know, I raised a girl, and so I have a lot of friends who are kids of mine, but they're not my kids, but they still call me dad. And so this car has become part of our family.
So in case you didn't pick up on that, the word is family.
I guess so, yeah. And so this is not a commuter car then. This just stays in the driveway, or they take it out for special events, or, you know, what do you do with it?
Venator will go do special events. Supernatural just had a convention in Seattle during our snowstorm, so I don't know how well attended it was. But Brad and Mary were there, and they brought Venator, and they were right in the valet area of the Westin Hotel here in Seattle, and they will bring it to fans. They've already lined it up for a few other conventions. There's Supernatural Day events where fans get together, and they got it planned to take out to those as well. There was another car in Washington called Mary the Impala, and that has since left the state. So now Venator is the only one locally.
I'm crossing my fingers that somebody starts a series with a 1998 VW Bug, because I got one of those.
Investment opportunity?
Yes, I want to see it grow in value rather than diminish to nothing.
Well, if anybody wants to do a 2001 Ford Focus hatchback, I'm all open.
Hannah, are there really normal-looking teenagers who are actually demons? That's my big question.
In real life or on the show?
In real life.
Who are actually demons?
Yeah.
Not that I'm aware of. Okay. They act like that sometimes.
I just want to double check.